The risen sun found them upon the top of a hill with a mist-blanketed valley lying below them. For the first time since they had started upon their wild ride, Lucas broke silence. "That is Beckering," he said, as they slid down through thick woods towards the bottom. They passed through a straggling village, not yet astir, and crossed a broad but shallow river by a humpbacked bridge. Then, turning off down a rutted side road, they followed the windings of the river bank for close upon a mile. Thick, neglected woods closed in upon them, and the uncared-for bank broke down into the water in bays and headlands that endangered the road. Little traffic could have passed along it, for it soon degenerated into a mere cart track, and the tires refused to grip the slimy weeds of its surface. Suddenly it broadened out, however, and a pair of brick pillars holding up rusty iron gates appeared upon their left. They went up a broad drive completely clothed in a green velvet of closer-growing moss, and Veronica was at last permitted to stretch her cramped limbs while Lucas banged on a door. The bell pull was too firmly rusted home to permit of its ringing, and Lucas, after an assault upon the knocker that echoed like a bombardment through the silent house, leaving Veronica in the company of the motorbike, went pushing through an overgrown shrubbery in search of the caretaker. At the end of close upon half an hour, Veronica, exhausted, frightened, and filled with a nameless horror by her dank and mouldering surroundings, heard sounds of movement approaching through the silent house. A great rattling of bolts followed, and the opening door revealed Lucas's sharp cut and somewhat drawn features, with a hag-like face peering over his shoulder. The leathern racing helmet he wore, backed by the marble pilasters of the porch, made Lucas look exactly like an Egyptian priest, and the huddled figure at his side seemed some strange familiar he had invoked for his magical work. A dingy crimson dressing gown had been hastily dragged on over an unbelievably dirty pink flannelette nightgown, and around all a gorgeous patchwork quilt was swathed, for the good dame had been aroused from her slumbers by the simple expedient of putting half a brick through her bedroom window. She peered at Veronica through hanging elf locks of grey hair and, addressing her as dearie, started a long rigmarole, apparently of apology for the state of the house and garden, but so toothless was she, that not one word could be made out. Lucas solved the problem of this address of welcome by pushing her aside, and taking the now almost fainting girl by the arm, he led her into the house. "Come along," he said. "There is one decent room in this mausoleum, anyway. We will have a fire put in it and the place will soon look more cheerful." He led the shrinking girl down a long passage to what had apparently been a billiard room, though the table was gone. Rugs covered the polished floor, low bookcases stood round the walls from the tops of which enormous fish goggled at the intruders in their varnished dignity. Guns stood in a rack at one end, and a litter of fishing tackle filled all four corners. Lucas dropped Veronica into one of the great leather armchairs and went to open the shutters, letting in a flood of early morning sunshine, and when the hag, who, for all her years, moved with a mouse-like quickness, returned with a bundle of brushwood and kindled a fire upon the great open hearth, the place looked far from unprepossessing. An oval mahogany table inlaid according to Victorian taste stood in the window, and Lucas and the hag between them carried it over to the fire. In a marvelously short space of time, bacon and eggs and tea appeared upon it, and the two travellers who since their entry into this dismal house had hardly addressed each other, set to work upon their welcome meal. Nothing but the commonplaces of the table passed between them till Lucas lit his after-breakfast pipe. "Listen to me, Veronica," he said. "That is, if you can keep your eyes open, and you had better keep them open until I have told you what I have to say, because it is very important. We are in a very tight hole, both of us, at the present moment. The trouble may blow over. On the other hand, it may not, and then we shall have to look out for squalls. I shall know pretty soon. All you have got to do is to stop here and keep absolutely quiet. You can tea-talk to this old dame, whatever her name is, because you can tea-make her here, and you mustn't tea-try to talk to anyone else. Don't tea-communicate with your friends, either, especially the Ashlots. This is most important, because your only chance of safety is for no one to know of your existence. Understand this, Veronica, we are in grave danger, very grave danger, both of us. Veronica had only to look at his strained face to know that he spoke the truth, or at least what he believed to be the truth, but she did not feel alarmed. Horror she might feel of the house and the whole situation, but she felt no anxiety for her personal safety. Her companion, however, seemed to take a different view of the matter. Lucas, glancing at his watch every other minute, allowed himself half an hour's rest, and then he announced that he must set forth upon his return journey. He heaved himself out of his chair and stood looking at Veronica as if he expected some move upon her part. She, however, stared vaguely back at him as usual, not knowing what was expected of her by this unaccountable being. "Aren't you coming to see me off?" he said. She rose obediently, and followed him, dog-like as usual, across the tiled hall to the front door. In the porch he paused, and looked steadfastly at the girl beside him. Then he suddenly caught her and drew her to him. "Veronica," he said, "you've got no one to look to but me, and I've got no one but you, we have got to stick together." Veronica's soft little heart was easily touched. She only saw the man's face, strained, tired and anxious, close to hers. Everything that had gone before was forgotten. It was a different Lucas, changed and softened, who stood before her now. Almost involuntarily she smiled back at him. It was the first time Lucas had ever seen her smile, and so completely did it change her face that he hardly knew her for the same girl. His arms tightened about her, and before he knew what he was doing, he had kissed her. Then, reluctantly, he released her and turned away. Half in the saddle of his cycle, and half out of it, he paused, and looked at Veronica again. Then suddenly he leant towards her. "I shall come back again," he said. "I shall come back again, dear, whether or no. Wait for me, Veronica." Chapter 6. Sounds in the hall of the big house in the Bloomsbury Square showed that the members of the council were assembling for their meeting. The butler, who was also a lay brother, was admitting them, and one by one they passed down the long tiled passage to the room built out at the back, which was designed for a billiard room but was now the lodge of an occult fraternity. In the office the secretary of that society was gathering together the papers that concerned the business about to be transacted. A close observer might have noticed that the lines of the man's dark face had deepened, adding some 10 years to his apparent age, and that his eyes appeared to be deep sunk in his head and heavy-lidded, save for that, and some dust-covered motoring clothes, rolled hastily into a bundle and thrown into the corner. There was nothing to show that he had travelled over 200 miles during the night. His papers made ready, he paused, and unlocking a cupboard that stood upon the safe, he poured himself out the best part of half a tumblerful of whiskey and swallowed down the raw spirit without water. By the time he had walked down the passage that led to the billiard room, the lines also had gone from his face. The members of the council had already assembled, and the secretary's entrance was the signal for them to take their places about the table and proceed to the transaction of business. The minutes of the preceding meeting were read and signed, and the matters on the agenda proceeded as usual. Then came the time when the chairman said, "Any other business?" and looked from face to face of the men surrounding the table. Each responded with a shake of the head, and the man at the foot of the table was permitting his lungs to expand in a sigh of relief when the chairman broke the silence. "There is a matter, brethren, which I should like to lay before you, and upon which I should value your advice. Last night a ritual was being worked in this lodge, the ritual of the 7th degree. I was in the chair. Suddenly I perceived a figure materialize upon the floor of the lodge. Several of the other brethren perceived it also. By means of a word of power I was able to banish it, and we proceeded with the ritual, but it is a very serious thing that any Cowan should have been able to pass through the seal set upon the room." Grave faces received this announcement. They knew how serious the matter was. Occult fraternities have guarded their secrets, not only physically, but mentally also by means of the mystic seals they set upon their meeting places, and here was a fraternity, one of the oldest and most powerful in the Western Hemisphere, faced by the fact that a stranger had succeeded in penetrating into the working of one of their highest degrees. The old man with the long white beard upon the chairman's left spoke first. Are you sure that it was a Cowan? I have known it happen that a member of the fraternity, taken over to the other side by sudden death, had attended lodge from sheer habit, forgetting that he was no longer in the body. These men were as accustomed to functioning out of the body as in it. There appeared nothing strange in the statement that the dead had returned. They were used to sitting in council with men who had been dead for hundreds of years or who were separated from them by the breadth of a continent. The only thing that puzzled them was, how the seal upon their meeting place had been broken by one who was not entitled to enter, and the chairman replied, "It could not have been a member of the fraternity, because it was a woman." Lucas waited with suspended breath to learn whether the intruder had been sufficiently clearly materialized to be recognizable. He dared not ask any questions. The pupils of his eyes had contracted to pinpoints and his face was set like a mask. The discussion turned this way and that for some minutes, and the consensus of opinion seemed to be that some outsider with considerable occult knowledge had succeeded in breaking the seal and effecting an entrance. Such a thing had not happened since the 16th century, when the Paris Lodge had been similarly invaded, and to this occurrence they turned for a precedent that should guide them in their course of action. The fraternity had in its keeping the secret of the use of the punitive dark rays of disintegration, and these it was permitted to employ upon the occasions, happily rare, when its secrets were in danger of being revealed to the uninitiated. Not that the brethren were bloodthirsty men, but the secret knowledge entrusted to them was of such power that its dissemination among those unfit for such a supreme trust was a very serious matter indeed, too serious to be trifled with, and when occult knowledge got into unworthy hands, those who were responsible for its safe custody were required to prevent effectually any use or spread of such knowledge. If a man chose to spy upon their secrets, then he must take the consequences, for the knowledge was not theirs to communicate at will, neither had they the right to pardon a transgression. Some of the brethren, having regard to the fact that the transgressor was believed to be a woman, though the chairman was not absolutely certain upon this point, hesitated to cast their votes in favor of action, and though no one actually refused to sanction the use of the dark ray upon this occasion, two abstained from voting, so the remaining five carried the decision. They had a grave trust to fulfill in safeguarding the knowledge placed in their keeping. Someone had learned their secrets, and that person must, at all costs, be effectually silenced. Only thus could their trust be held to have been fulfilled. Lucas himself was perfectly safe. The brethren had no means of associating the intruder with himself. She, and she alone, would be struck by the dark ray. He had only to send round once more to the secretarial agencies of London in order to replace her with a sensitive equally or almost as good. Yet he sat staring at the chairman like a hypnotized man, his soul frozen with horror. Absorbed in their discussion, no one looked at the secretary, or his face must surely have betrayed him. Lucas, who had thought himself beyond good or evil, immune from emotion, had been humanized, and his humanity betrayed him. A man upon the left-hand path finds his strength in separateness. Lucas had formed a tie, he had deviated from his perfect loyalty to evil. The spark of good that was in him had been fanned to a flame, and it was proving his undoing. The brethren were discussing ways and means, who were to be responsible for the task in hand, and the time and place at which they should meet for the united meditation that should let loose the dark ray, and they did not realize that anything untoward was afoot until the scrape of a thrust-back chair drew their attention to the foot of the table. Lucas was upon his feet, his face was the peculiar grey-white, absolutely bloodless. For a long minute the men round the table stared at him, arrested by the expression of his face. It seemed as if he would never find his voice, and then, with difficulty, the words came. "There is something I wish to say to you," he said. The chairman signed to him to go on. For some time past the secretary had been an object of suspicion, and it did not come as any surprise to the men present that Lucas was involved in the affair under consideration. They waited for him to pull himself together. Presently he spoke again. "This matter is not quite as you think it is. Another long pause followed as Lucas sought for the words that would not come. The men round the table waited immobile in the half-light of the shaded lamp, their gaze directed towards him, no one offering to help him out. With a renewed effort he continued. The person you saw in the lodge was not directly concerned in the matter. She was entirely passive. A trance medium, in fact. She is not responsible for anything that has happened. Then, said the chairman, if she is not responsible, who is?
I am, said Lucas. I was operating her.
In what way? Under hypnosis. Has she any recollection of what has happened?
No, none, I swear she hasn't.
She was nothing but a tool. She had no more to do with it than a pen with what it signs. If you want to strafe anybody, you can strafe me. I am the person responsible.
It was a strange scene in the darkened Bloomsbury room.
The circle of men round the table, their faces dimly illumined by the reflected light from the shaded lamp, behind them, a shadowy altar with the everlasting fire glowing dimly upon it, and before them, erect, tense, solitary, the man who was about to die. For there could be no doubt as to what the verdict would be. A long time ago the chiefs had known that Lucas was unsuitable to be a member of the fraternity. For some time past it had been suspected almost to certainty that he was intriguing against them, and now they had caught him red-handed. He, a member of the Outer Temple, had obtained possession of the secrets of the Inner Temple up to the seventh degree. They were not only angry at the theft, but thoroughly alarmed that such a theft had been possible, and their alarm made them ruthless. The chairman spoke. There are two courses open to us should a man obtain the secrets of a degree he is not entitled to. Either we can administer the oath of the degree to him, or we can silence him. Are you willing that the oath should be administered to our brother here present? One by one, as he glanced at them, the men shook their heads. Then, said the chairman, we have no option but to proceed with the other course. He did not put the vote to the meeting. It was doubtful if he could have got the men to vote, for it was a sentence of death they were passing, and though their minds were made up, to give that deciding nod was not easy, and the motion would have passed without opposition if the voice of the old man with the long white beard had not broken the silence. Though we are not willing to admit this man to the degrees he has desecrated, is there no other course than to invoke the dark ray? What other course would you suggest? Replied the chairman. Can we not bind him with an oath, and bid him depart? What have the brethren to say upon the matter? Said the chairman, looking round at the assembled men again. There was a long silence, no one caring to take the responsibility of voicing the thought that was in the minds of all of them. The man they were trying stood tense as a bowstring, his nostrils twitching like an animal's and his eyes, now opaque as marble, now pools of blackness. At length the journalist broke the silence. Daren't he risk it? Can't he trust him? He said, and the rest breathed a sigh of relief that they had been spared the voicing of the verdict. Is that your opinion? Asked the chairman, again referring to the assembled men, who, each in his way, by a nod or a half-spoken word, assented, save only the patriarch, and his voice once more broke upon the assembly. We have long known this man for what he is, he said. A man dedicated to the services of evil, following the left-hand path, a black occultist, and yesterday, had I been asked, I should have voted as you have done. But can we say that this man is wholly given over to evil, to separateness? Remember, you are condemning him upon a voluntary confession. Unless he had spoken, we should never have known. And he has elected to sacrifice himself rather than that an innocent person should suffer. A man in love will do anything, said the journalist, and Lucas started as if hot metal had touched him. The words, or the sneer with which they were spoken, seemed to galvanize him into activity. For a moment he stood there, as if poised for flight, and then his hand went to his hip pocket, and the assembly found themselves looking down the barrel of a revolver. If you want me, you can come and fetch me, he snarled. Strafing is a game that two can play at. And he backed slowly towards the door, glaring at them along the shining barrel of the revolver. You can put up your weapon, Mr. Lucas, said the chairman coldly.
We shall not use physical force. Lucas slammed the door behind him and turned the key. The lodge room was remote from the house and the Ashlots abode in the basement. Some delay must occur before the brethren could effect egress. He dashed down the long tiled passage to the office, snatched the papers out of his private safe, and raced upstairs to his bedroom. Here he caught up just such personal belongings as might readily be thrust into a haversack, then he rushed downstairs again. A thundering upon the door at the end of the tiled passage showed that he was only just in time, and catching up a handful of letters that had fallen from the letterbox upon the hall mat, he passed out of the old house in the Bloomsbury Square where his life had been lived and his life work had been done. A new order of existence opened before him. What it held for him was unknown, and never had any man more completely burnt his boats behind him. Soon he was speeding down the road. The excitement of the happenings buoyed him up and he felt no fatigue, but as he drew clear of the London traffic into the open country roads and had time for thought, a realization of his position dawned upon him. He was out of a job to begin with, and had very little prospect of getting one. He was not penniless, he had a small sum in the bank, but, as he remarked to himself, it would not last the two of them very long. Veronica had nothing but what she stood up in, and he very little more. They could probably squat indefinitely in the General S fishing box, and he might be able to make some use of his pen, but it was a precarious living at best. Lucas was not an introspective man. If he had been, he might have noticed that his resources would last just twice as long for one as for two. He dared not use Veronica again, and there was no reason why he should not cut loose from her. One is not obliged to employ a secretary one does not require. All the same, it never occurred to him to abandon her. For the first time in his life, the man's strange nature had formed a tie. He had not yet had time to reason things out, but a flash of self-revelation had come to him at the words of the journalist, "A man in love will do anything." Was he in love with Veronica? He hardly even asked himself the question. He only knew that with the instinct of a homing pigeon, he was going back to her as fast as his machine would take him. She was the only creature with whom he was in touch in the midst of an alien and hostile world. Bereft of Veronica, he would be utterly alone. The mileage he had travelled began to tell upon him, and it was a very weary man who looked down from the crest of the hills upon the valley of Beckering, spread out in the afternoon sun. By the time he reached the rough cart track along the river bank, it was all he could do to hold the cycle steady. Knowing it to be useless to ring the bell, he made his way round through the shrubbery to the rear of the house. Veronica, sitting over her tea, looked up to see a man come with uncertain steps across the grass and knock upon the French window for admission. She sprang up and opened to him, and he crossed the threshold without a word and dropped into a chair beside the table. She asked no questions, she never did. He was a remote, unaccountable being upon whom she had no claims, but her woman's instinct made her give him a cup of tea and watch with satisfaction while he drank it. His face and clothes were covered with a mask of dust, and he looked more than ever like the statue of some fallen Egyptian king in a forgotten tomb that the sands of the desert have overcome. There was a curiously changed feel about him. He no longer conveyed a sense of power and aloofness. The mysterious force he always seemed to emanate was gone. He was simply a very tired man, and in some subtle way he had drawn very much closer to her. He drank, but would not eat, and when the third cup of tea had passed his dust-grimed lips, he rose stiffly to his feet, and laid a hand upon Veronica's shoulder. "I am going to sleep. I am absolutely dunning. Watch by me. Don't ye leave me alone." And he flung himself, dust and all, upon a broad leather sofa that stood at the side of the hearth. He gave her no reason why she should watch beside him while he slept. He would have found it difficult to have formulated one to himself, but he felt the greatest aversion from being left alone. Veronica watched the golden afternoon light fade to dusk, and then a shuffling in the passage announced the advent of the old caretaker with supper. When she saw Lucas asleep on the sofa, she mumbled something unintelligible and went to fetch a second plate. She seemed quite to have accepted their presence in the house for which she was responsible. Roused by her movements, Lucas woke up, and rose to go and wash off the dust. As he shed his motoring overalls, he felt something bulky in the pocket, and drew out the bundle of letters he had picked up as he left the house. Two were for the Ashlots, the rest for the fraternity, but one was addressed to him personally. The Ashlots letters he tore up and flung in the hearth. He dared not risk sending them on. His safety lay largely in the ignorance of the brethren as to his whereabouts, for it is very difficult to focus an occult force unless one has some idea as to at least the point of the compass to which it is to be directed. The letters for the fraternity he glanced through out of pure curiosity. Their writers would have to wait for an answer. Then he opened the letter addressed to himself. It was brief and to the point, and without any preamble, informed him that General Sawbury had passed peacefully away at his working home early the previous morning, and that he himself was the principal legatee. Lucas let out a long whistle. What astonishing luck, and just when he needed it, too. If the rest of his luck were as good as this, he would pull through all right. He put the letter in his pocket and went down to supper, patting Veronica on the back in the most friendly fashion as he took his seat at the table. After supper, smoking a pipe, and covertly watching Veronica as she read, he again congratulated himself upon his good fortune. He was master of this house, queer old ramshackle place though it was. He asked nothing better than to be left alone in the possession of his newly acquired resources to develop the novel experience that had come into his life. If only the fraternity would let him alone. Perhaps if he disappeared completely from their ken they would forget all about him in time, or at any rate get over their age. He did not wish to think about that dark ray and its effects. They were not a pleasant subject of meditation. He remembered the German-American who had preferred to plunge into Niagara Gorge rather than face exposure to the force of that ray. If it had not been for Veronica, he himself would have followed some such course. But there was Veronica, with the lamplight throwing into relief the soft curves of chin and throat, and who held his attention and interest in a queer, subtle fashion. He longed to win some sort of response from her. Just such another smile as she had given him upon his departure for London, and he sat there, watching her in that dimlit, tobacco-clouded room, planning how he might bring that smile to her lips again. The dog-like, cowed Veronica was of no use to him. He wanted a Veronica who would come of her own free will, and, above all, would smile. He could not forget that smile. It was the first time any woman had shown him that side of her nature, the first time, indeed, that he had ever sought to call it forth, for those smiles are not bestowed upon cynical, cold-blooded men, such as he had trained himself to be. But fundamentally Lucas was neither cynical nor cold-blooded, he was a hot-blooded man with quick emotions and strong enthusiasms. He had always believed that the race can best be served by those who have no tie or bond of affection, forgetting that a man who has never loved does not know how to love. And now Lucas was getting his training. As he had surmised, he and Veronica had followed the way of initiation together for many lives until he had quitted the path, and then their ways had divided. But now, with her re-entry upon the scene of his life, the old influence was reasserting itself and he was being slowly drawn back towards the path. His loyalty to Veronica had been prompted by a dread of losing her rather than any concern for her welfare, but still, it was love, a germinating seed, if not the perfect flower. Chapter 7. Next morning Lucas, accompanied by Veronica, set out to explore his little estate. With the exception of the lawn in front of the house, the rest of the grounds consisted of shrubbery and woodland, both much overcrowded and neglected. Straggling laurels grew up like small trees, and oaks, herded together in ragged negligence, lost all their native dignity and contrived to produce a sinister twilight in the underworld of their groves. Lucas had no intention of reconstructing this domain, but it pleased him to explore its resources. Only the cart track lay between the grounds and the river, and as the boundary was marked by a single strand of slack and rusting wire, the division was more legal than actual fact. Many trees had fallen and lay slowly rotting in the green twilight onto the shadowed river, for here the bed deepened and the banks narrowed, and the current ran through a gorge of overhanging trees. Occasionally a vole plopped into the water, occasionally a kingfisher shot like a streak of blue down the narrow path of sunlight in the river's center, and Lucas spoke of life in general, and his own in particular.